Proceed to the second case of the day. Indiana Funeral Directors versus Benefit Actuaries. Mr. Price.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Gary Price with David Gray. I'm here representing the appellant in this case, the Indiana Funeral Insurance Trust. I will call it IFIT or the Trust. In part is relevant here. This appeal followed a lawsuit that was filed by IFIT against Benefit Actuaries for negligence, which we allege to be in the nature of actuarial malpractice and bad advice. IFIT lost in partial summary judgment, and we lost in a trial on the merits before the magistrate judge. Although in our briefing we have asserted numerous errors that we believe the district court committed or made in reaching its decision from which this appeal follows, I concentrate on what I believe are the most significant primary errors, particularly, number one, the court's confused and seemingly contradictory and mutually exclusive conclusions of law regarding the duties benefit actuaries assumed, the standard of care was obligated to conform its practices to, and the failure of the court to impose liability despite finding benefit actuaries negligent in setting reserves. In the memorandum opinion, in the memorandum portion of the court's opinion, the court, quote, concedes that benefit actuaries gave IFIT bad advice, unquote, and notes that ultimately the question that it must decide is, quote, whether this bad advice was so deficient as to fall below the standard of ordinary care under all of the circumstances, unquote. But the court erred in determining what standard of care benefit actuaries owed in holding the company to that standard. And this is reflected earlier in what I call the formal findings of fact and conclusions of law, in conclusion number four, where the court stated, quote, as a matter of law, unquote, that the duty owed by benefit actuaries to the trust, quote, was more than a typical insurance broker's duty to exercise reasonable care and good faith diligence in procuring insurance, unquote. In fact, the court went on to conclude in that conclusion of law that, quote, benefit actuaries had a duty to provide advice with regard to the operation and maintenance of a self-insured MEWA, multiple employer welfare arrangement, commensurate with the degree of care or skill exercised or possessed by other professionals, my emphasis, engaged in advising and administering self-insured plans under similar circumstances, unquote. Now, we presume, and I believe it's every inference, is that the professionals that the magistrate judge was referring to were actuaries, because that was the only expert opinion and evidence that was at issue in the trial. However, we don't know, and I still don't know today, after making a finding or a conclusion of law, number four in the findings of fact, as to this heightened standard of care and duty requiring benefit actuaries to assume the responsibilities of professionals, and then in its opinion, his memorandum explaining his findings of fact, directly contradicting what he said in his conclusions of law, what standard exactly did the magistrate judge apply in reviewing the facts and evidence in this case? We would submit, the trust would submit, that if you look at the conclusion of law that established the standard of care, then it clearly was breached. The magistrate judge conceded that when he said benefit actuaries gave these people bad advice. Then he seems, however, to explain his ultimate finding of no liability by saying, well, they didn't do anything that breached a standard of, quote, ordinary care, unquote, among insurance people who do this kind of work.
Well, what was the bad advice?
The bad advice was a historical failure for many, many, many years to follow actuarially sound formulas and practices in establishing reserves that are a vital and necessary component of a self-insured program.
The more they raise these premiums here, the fewer participants there would be in the plan. Isn't that how these things sort of work?
In the abstract, that economic model is correct.
Only in the abstract. I mean, you're a self-insured plan, and you pick some level where catastrophic things are going to be covered by an insurance policy. so you have to pay for that. Depending on where you put that level, and what happened here is you had that level pretty high, so that keeps the payments low, as I understand it. Maybe I'm all off base on this, but you get a lot of claims, and that eats away at all the reserves. And the only way you can keep this thing afloat is by increasing all these premiums on these small funeral home directors, employees, and so on. And the higher the premiums go, the less likely they are to stay in the plan. Isn't that kind of how it works?
You're partially correct, Your Honor, but what you need to understand, and what I think the magistrate judge focused on, was over the 20-plus years that Benefit Actuaries was giving actuarial advice, which it was not qualified to give, there should have been a steady building of the reserve component of this self-insured fund. And in turn, that reserve component would have addressed what is at issue in this case, or what actually happened. You had unexpected aggregate losses that exceeded the attachment point.
You had a huge cluster of claims that came in a couple of years.
A statistically significant cluster, yes.
Yeah, but what are the trustees doing all this time? Don't they realize that they're sort of living hand to mouth?
No.
Why?
Because they weren't given the information that a reasonably prudent actuary would have given them for many, many years about the fact that they were living hand to mouth and about the actual risk that this self-insured plan of small Indiana funeral insurance directors was actually taking upon itself. The best way I can put it, and there's no legal elegant way, they trusted Benefit Actuaries. And if Benefit Actuaries said, raise the attachment point, they raised the attachment point. As the magistrate judge pointed out, throughout the history of the operation and during the time that Benefit Actuaries was giving advice, this idea of the stabilization reserve, the rainy day fund, whatever you wish to call it, it was a loose target. If extra money came in, fine. If no extra money came in, well, that's okay. There was no extra money. I look at this, and we tried to urge the magistrate judge to look at this case. Look at the duty they accepted. They acted as actuaries, and they did not provide enough information to give the trustees the ability to make an informed judgment, informed consent. If they had been told all along, as the magistrate judge criticizes them for, you are living on the edge. You are running a high-risk program here that can fall apart by virtue of aggregate losses, by virtue of your inadequate reserve funds, by virtue of any number of factors which the actuarial experts did talk about and testify about at trial, then I would agree. These gentlemen would have made an informed decision to go ahead, accept the risk, and move forward in this benefit health benefit plan. They didn't have that information. And I beg to differ, and I'm not going to add anything that this panel doesn't know or can't know from its review of the record, but this notion that the idea of a rainy day fund goes back to Moses, I find to be inconsistent with the fact that, for example, the Michigan legislature and now the Indiana legislature has a very rigorous regulatory scheme for MIWAs that address all of the issues, if all the wheels that fell off of this program: actuarial review, actuarial consulting, actuarial formulas to make sure that proper reserves are in place for these plans. In other words, if this is something where, gosh, any small businessman should know that, then I find it starkly at odds with legislative determinations that put in place all of the regulatory controls, in which, by the way, Jack Matthews, the senior partner of Benefit Actuary, said, well, we run all our plans the way Michigan says to run it. Well, that's simply not the case. And the uncontroverted testimony at trial confirmed that it was not the case.
Mr. Price, maybe you could give me some background, help me understand a little bit how responsible the actuaries are to the trust. On day one, there's no history to the trust, I mean, when you started, right?
Right.
So is it the responsibility, as you understand it, of the actuaries to import a standard from what looks like a similar trust model in another industry? I mean, I understand how you might have a record after 5 years, so you know, build up. But how does that start? What's the initial responsibility?
I'm out of time, but briefly, it's called manual rating.
As long as we're asking questions, you're not out of time.
It's called manual rating, and actuaries put together from extensive databases claims experience and the other information which they need to do their work.
Right.
The problem in this case, as the actuary's own expert pointed out when I examined him in deposition, is that when he came up with the attachment points from the manual rating, I pointed out to him, well, wait a minute. These are all single employer plans. This is a multi-employer plan, which presents another whole level of risks. And that he kind of stared and said, well, reduce it by 10 to 20%. So I'm not saying that this is an exact science, but what I'm saying is it does require a level of skill and expertise, which benefit actuaries never had, never applied, but held themselves out in the very title of the company to provide, then failed to provide until the demise of this trust. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Price. Mr. Cantrell?
May it please the court, my name is Fenn Cantrell and I represent the defendant Benefit Actuaries. I'm happy to address any of the issues that have been raised in the brief in any order that the court would prefer, but I'm also happy to focus on the issue that my colleague has raised. And first of all, I'd like to point out that I believe the appellant has misrepresented the determination of the district court with respect to the issue of the setting of the reserves. The court specifically found, following the bench trial, that Benefit Actuaries had not breached any duty with respect to the setting of reserves. So in the appellant is simply incorrect in concluding that the district court found that there had been an error. Specifically, in the short appendix, the district court said, of course, one could say that all the foregoing analysis shows is that BA gave bad advice and the trust simply followed it to its eventual inevitable outcome, the demise of the trust. The court concedes the advice was bad in retrospect. In other words, with the hindsight, with 2020 hindsight, it might have been better if they had had more reserves. But that's not to say that, given the information available at the time, that the recommendations that were given by Benefit Actuaries was deficient. And in fact, based on the totality of the evidence, the court found that the advice was sufficient. In this case, we have to point out that the trustees who had managed this trust had served for many, many years. Mr. Lee, the chairman of the board, had served as the chairman since 1974. And this plan had continued on from 1974 up until the financial problems in 1997. With all due respect, the district court found that the trustees' claims of ignorance with respect to the necessity for maintaining reserves simply didn't ring true. These trustees had served long enough to know the issues that they were faced with and to understand the risks they were assuming by their very nature as a self-funded insurance plan.
Is it fair to say it worked for over 20 years?
I'm sorry?
Is it fair to say whatever they were doing worked for 20 years?
Your Honor, in 1984, it's not entirely fair. So in 1984, the trustee went from a program where they had the first dollar liability with major medical coverage.
Okay.
To a self-funded plan. But from 1984 until 1997, a period of over 10 years, they certainly did act in this fashion. And in fact, in the 1994-1995 plan year, the trust had experienced a similar situation where there were claims that were coming in that had outstripped the premiums that were coming in from the members. With the recommendation of benefit actuaries, the trust had to raise the rates that it had charged to the members to increase the future cash flow and to do a special assessment or a contingent premium, which was a one-time assessment of the members to instantly infuse cash into the trust to pay the claims. They also had to make changes to the content of the plan to reduce the amount of benefits payable to the beneficiaries. So in 1994, 1995, the trustees had experienced this exact same situation, and so they had to understand that they were living, as Your Honor had said, from hand to mouth in terms of not having a large reserve level built up. And as the court noted very accurately, the idea of saving money for a rainy day is as old as Moses. Now, the court found, though, that the reason that the advice by benefit actuaries was not deficient was because of the fact that the trustees did not want to pay the money that would be required to build up the large reserve level that we are talking about. One of the problems with the plaintiff's case from the very get-go was that they could never prove damages. They could never prove that but for the negligence or the alleged negligence of benefit actuaries, that the trust would have been better off. There was no model to show that if some additional advice had been given to the trust, that they would have taken some other action and thereby been in some better position.
Were they at some point advised that they would have to raise the premium and maybe raise the stop loss level? Because obviously the stop loss, they make decisions from an insurance point of view as well, and they would look at whatever they're, it's called, I guess that's a catastrophic risk, isn't it, stop loss? Isn't that what that protects again? Some major?
Your Honor, there's two types of stop loss that was at issue in this
individual
case.
Individual and aggregate.
That's correct. The specific stop loss, which covers claims for an individual within the applicable period of the stop loss policy that incurs claims above the specific stop loss deductible. And yes, over time, the specific stop loss deductible was raised from $40,000 to $50,000 and then from $50,000 to $60,000.
And of course, if it were lower, the premium would be more, I presume.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But I'm just wondering, when the trustees are dealing with this, is there an economic decision, say, if we raise the as Judge Flom earlier addressed, if we raise the premium, or the premium too high, people are going to opt out. Was that a feature or a problem?
Well, absolutely.
Or did the trustees at least consider that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If the specific stop-loss deductible was decreased, thereby limiting the risk to the trust, the premium dollars that Trustmark, the stop-loss carrier, charged back to the trust would increase. And therefore, the trust would have to increase the premiums that it in turn charged to the individual members. So that would in turn increase the operating expenses and the ultimate end cost to the individual members of the plan, yes.
And a raised stop loss would also increase the exposure of self-insurance.
That's correct. If the specific stop loss deductible is raised, the trust is retaining more risk and not shifting that to the insurance company. Now, obviously, the insurance company is charging a premium to the plan for the specific stop loss risk. The greater the risk that's shifted to the insurance company, the greater the premium that the insurance company is going to charge to the plan. The testimony in this case was that benefit actuaries discussed thoroughly this trade-off with the trustees, and the trustees made their decisions. And in fact, the district court looked at the evidence that was introduced at trial and found that the evidence suggested that even if you had retained the specific stop-loss deductible at lower levels, there would have been very minimal benefits based on the claims history that was introduced, but the likely cost, additional cost in premiums, would have more than offset in some cases, and maybe in about a $5,000 benefit to the trust in one particular plan year, resulting in during the relevant time frame an increase in the cost to the net cost to the trust if they had in fact maintained the lower deductible. Your Honor, in this case, the plaintiff simply failed to present any evidence that established either the breach of duty in this case or the damages. Because the plaintiff had simply failed to carry its burden of proof, the trial court was well within its discretion to enter a judgment after the bench trial in this case in favor of the defendant. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm finished. All
right, thank you, Mr. Cantrell. Mr. Price?
Excuse me if I jump around, but I'd like to cover as many topics as I can in rebuttal. I think Judge Mannion hit upon a key factor here. Yes, as the attachment point goes up, the risk to the self-insured plan goes up. But the evidence at trial was that none of the trustees had ever heard of aggregate stop-loss insurance coverage until the wheels came off and the trust was in financial ruin. This is one of the things that a reasonably competent actuary would have discussed with trustees over the year. The magistrate judge did obviously put a lot of responsibility on the trustees' shoulders, and again, I have to wonder, if this was all so simple, why did we need benefit actuaries taking 7% off the top all these many, many, many years? There had to be a reason, and in fact, in conclusion of law number 4, the magistrate judge does say that there is this heightened duty of care, and they're held to the standard of professionals. And then I'm led to the logical inference, well, what professionals? Actuarial professionals. Did they go along year after year living from hand to mouth? Yes. I think that's what the evidence shows. Were they informed of the risks that they were incurring by going along year after year? No. That's what the evidence shows. The magistrate judge said unequivocally, this whole idea of the rainy day fund, the stabilization reserve, was treated by benefit actuaries as a quote-unquote loose target. Not something that each of the actuaries on each side of the case said has to be an important and critical component of the actuarial calculations for reserves. If they had been accumulating funds, investing those funds, there would have been money. There would have been, when the rainy day came, sufficient reserves to pay the claims. And in terms of damages, I didn't want to put the cart before the horse. I've always been astounded at the decision of the district judge applying the Namias case. And basically, as he said in his formal findings, the court entered partial summary judgment and granted it with respect to the calculation of damages. It was like we had a judgment on the evidence at the summary judgment stage, but the magistrate judge said, but I'll let you go ahead and try your case. Well, I submit that the measure of damages is not controlled by the Namias case, which specifically says that it applies to a situation where an insurance broker undertakes a duty to procure insurance and then fails to do so. I have said again, and I think it's replete in the record, this is an actuarial malpractice case. Namias had no business being in this case, and effectively our ability to present evidence of damages was truncated and eliminated by the earlier decisions of the magistrate judge, which he then confirmed in his opinion and findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Now, Mr. Price, are you quarreling with the court's finding that there was no financial peril prior to the death spiral in 97?
Oh, I am. That we all know there was financial peril. There was an unacceptable level of risk.
So he committed clear error when he suggests there was no finding that there was no financial peril prior to 97.
That is correct. And more importantly, from this tribunal's point of view, in looking at the conclusions de novo, what bothers me the most is how can you reconcile, and I think Judge Evans was on a panel very recently when Judge Posner in the Erdstrom case said, look, if a judge is telling you how he's thinking about things and he's wrong, you can't ignore it. And I am at a loss to say, how in the world can you reconcile an opinion from a trial court that says, an opinion in conclusion of law 4, it's a heightened standard of care, that they're held to the standard of professionals, where in the memorandum explaining that, he says, no, I didn't mean that. It's only ordinary court. That is a clear error of law. And I wish there could be some other remedy, but the only remedy is to vacate and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Thank you, Ms. Cantrell. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.